Hello, we are delighted to be here today as part of a series of podcasts being run for our professional practices group. My name is Anna Birtwistle and I'm a partner in our employment team. I specialise in advising on employment and partnership law. In the context of our professional partnerships group, that means advising firms either in the professional services space or financial services space, and often that includes arising on issues to do with their employees and their partners, and particularly investigations into misconduct issues. I've advised both firms conducting investigations into partner or employee misconduct, as well as individuals that are subject to investigations. And the types of investigations I tend to be involved in might include alleged sexual harassment or theft of confidential information. Now, given the regulated nature of the clients we work for, our practice benefits immensely from having specialist regulatory advice. And that's why I'm delighted today to be talking to my partner, Gerard Hayes, who'll be sharing his insights and tips. Gerard is a partner in our disputes team and specializes in contentious regulatory advice, particularly focused on contentious regulatory issues for asset management and investment funds, covering litigation and in particular investigations. We'll be looking today at some of the key issues that can come up in the course of an investigation for a firm. Many of the issues and principles we'll be looking at will be the same regardless of the regulatory context. Although we won't be able to cover everything today that firms need to think about, we will hopefully be able to give you a flavour of some of the main points to have in mind. So Gerard, starting at the beginning, how might an investigation be triggered in the first place?
Hi Anna. Really, it's quite a broad spectrum of things that might give rise to an investigation, but I can definitely provide some examples. So it might arise as a result of a whistleblower made either through a firm's internal channels or for raising concerns, or through a whistleblower directly to a regulator following a review by internal audit, or because of a potential issue flagged by a firm's surveillance tools, arising out of regulatory supervisory work because of regulatory enforcement trends impacting similar businesses, which may lead a firm to investigate and understand its own compliance and that of its employees and senior managers in the course of considering and resolving complaints due to a product or business line failure and subsequent review of the causes of that failure as a result of allegations made during litigation or disciplinary proceedings, following direct intervention from a regulator, including supervisory interactions and discussions, or due to an external market event prompting either an internal or external review of the risks faced by a firm as a result of that market event. So, I mean, there's some examples, Anna, but I won't say endless, but there's certainly a long list of situations that could trigger the investigation.
Yeah, so clearly a wide range of potential triggers. So I suppose once an issue or potential issue has been identified, then where might the firm first go from there?
There's no standard approach. I think, you know, where to start, what to focus on, the urgency of timeframes and next steps they're driven by the nature of the issues or allegations, and of course the facts. I mean, every investigation is different, and even within an investigation, as the facts develop, an investigation that appeared headed in a particular direction can very quickly change. I mean, having said that, while the approach may differ from case to case, the immediate question to be answered is whether to commence an investigation at all. Sometimes that decision will be taken out of a firm's hands where regulators are already aware of the issues and may already have started their own investigations. But where that's not the case, deciding whether or not to investigate involves getting a sense of the possible scale and scope of the problem, who's involved, what entities are involved, what breaches are alleged or may have arisen, what jurisdictions are covered, and what is known about the facts. And I think that, you know, on the facts, you know, depending on the trigger for the investigation, it can be difficult to know what they are without, conducting the very investigation the firm is seeking, you know, to determine whether or not to conduct. Even so, what you're doing at this stage is a form of, it's a form of early triage. How serious is the issue? Is it an issue, that's previously been identified and addressed? What risks does the issue or allegations, if true, posed to the firm, to individuals, to customers and to clients?
Yeah, I can see that. And sure, not every potential issue, I suppose, requires a formal investigation. I'd observe, though, and I'd be interested to get your thoughts, that at least from my end of the telescope, what we've seen is there being a real cultural shift towards firms actually proactively investigating potential misconduct in a way that perhaps they didn't do in the past. I've always thought there's a lot to do with the sort of cultural lens now. I think sort of cultural movements like Me Too in the context of things like, you know, sexual harassment have really made a difference, but also a lot to do with a change in approach from the regulators. The FCA, of course, has shone a spotlight on non-financial misconduct, and there's also the wider regulatory context of the fit and proper rules. So certainly what I've seen in financial services, and definitely in the context of solicitors and a more interventionist approach by the SRA, is that you certainly seem to see firms starting from the point of view of likely investigating rather than not, if there is any kind of credible complaint raised about misconduct.
And I agree with that. And I'm thinking particularly about hear about allegations that might arise as a result of whistleblowing allegations. Mm-hmm. And you know, I've seen a couple of these cases recently, and certainly I think there has been a cultural shift at firms where the starting point is that an investigation probably should be conducted unless there are compelling reasons why it shouldn't. That's not always the case, but I mean, I think with your overall point around a cultural shift, I certainly see that in the market in the same way that you do.
So assuming it is determined that there is then an issue or a set of facts that need to be investigated further, and assuming also that a regulatory investigation hasn't already been commenced, what should a firm start by thinking about?
I think the short answer is unfortunately quite a lot. And quite a lot of issues come into play all at once. I think to start with, thought needs to be given to who is going to have oversight of the investigation and who will conduct it. So, for example, in a partnership context, it may well be that there are allegations or potential issues involving senior employees or partners in a business that might, those individuals might otherwise expect to play a role in the oversight of an investigation and to be kept updated on the potential, on the identification of potential problems or the progress of an investigation. Alternatively, allegations may involve members of the legal, compliance or internal audit teams within those firms who might ordinarily have led or had input into the investigative process itself. So firms need to be mindful of the requirements of the policies and procedures they have in place in terms of the conduct of investigations, but also recognize, I think, that there may be circumstances driven by the nature and subject of the allegations where the prescribed internal process needs to be deviated from or at least thought about in light of the issues at play. Relevant policies and procedures may, of course, provide for what should happen in that very situation.
It's funny, when you're talking about policies and procedures, I have to say what I see in a lot of firms is that while they'll have very detailed policies relating to how they would undertake an investigation of an employee, quite often they come unstuck when you're talking about an investigation that concerns a partner. So you might see firms that have, clear in their employment contracts, clear rights to suspend, and they will follow a procedure for an investigation. As you say, that there may be circumstances where they have to divert from that policy, but that there tends to be for partners, not necessarily a mirror policy. And quite often the policy they have in place for employees doesn't apply to partners, and that can be an issue. And we would say it's very important when we're advising firms that they put in place those policies, or at least make clear that the policies that apply to employees will also apply to their partnership population as well. Also, just related to that point, I'd note that within the LLP agreement, you will want something there that requires partners to have to comply with an investigation policy. And in particular, the right, if the partners don't comply and cooperate with an investigation, that that can then lead to an express right for the firm to expel the partner in breach. Another consideration in this context is one of protecting the privilege of advice that the firm might wish to take in connection with misconduct. So we come across quite often the potential for a partner to be able to argue, given that they are a partner in the LLP or the firm, that they have a right to see the advice that the firm is taking in relation to a misconduct investigation. So here it's sensible for firms to have an express power within their LLP or their partnership agreement to take privileged advice without being required to disclose that advice to the partner who's under investigation themselves. And if the firm doesn't have that express right, then we have been faced with a scenario of having to go through processes to ensure that the partnership can appoint a group of partners to engage outside counsel, you know, on a personal group basis in order to protect the privilege of the advice that they're receiving. So moving on, if the LLP agreement doesn't contain an express right to do so, the firm's going to need to think about steps to appoint a committee who will instruct the investigator and perhaps might require resolutions to be taken by the partnership to allow them to do that. But what should they think about otherwise, you mentioned, in terms of who they appoint to undertake the investigation itself, in terms of leading the investigation, that is?
Yeah, so I mean, I think that question involves, you know, a lot of the issues that you just mentioned, Anna. So, you know, I think in short, in summary terms, you know, taking all of the issues that you just spoke about into account, you know, the key question is who within the firm is the right person with the right experience to have oversight of an investigation? And once that is determined, who will lead the investigation itself? So, for example, is external counsel input required, either on the ground or in, you know, providing direction? And if not, who in the firm will conduct the investigation? It will inevitably be the case that some investigations, due either to their scale, you know, complexity, or the potential seriousness of the issues, will require outside assistance, whereas others, you know, can be looked at internally, you know, with the right governance arrangements in place, without incurring the costs associated with outside assistance, you know, at least at the initial fact-finding stage.
And I'd say that where in the past professional services firms in particular were resistant to engaging external investigators, and you would quite often see, you know, compliance departments or HR within law firms, their employment team running investigations, that really does seem to have changed over the last few years. And actually, I'd say that makes a lot of sense, both from the perspective of the firm as well as the individual partner. Confidentiality is one reason for that, but also more importantly, from the perspective of protecting the impartiality of the subsequent decision makers, if an investigation is conducted that does find wrongdoing and is going to lead to some form of disciplinary action or potential expulsion of a partner.
Yeah, and I would agree with all of that, Anna. And then, of course, comes the question of self-reporting. You know, are the issues of a nature that they should be reported to a regulator or law enforcement body? So, you know, the FCA, the SRA, or the SFO in the UK, or to regulators in other jurisdictions? And, you know, if so, what form should they take? You know, verbal or oral, as part of ongoing supervisory conversations, etc.? Or is it the case that not enough is known about the facts at this stage, and a decision on any self-reporting obligations is one that has to be revisited once the investigation is further progressed and reliable facts become known?
And that's obviously something that our team would come to you to talk about. And there does seem to be some movement towards, where there are facts yet to be established, a sort of initial notification being made to a regulator with really sort of stripped back details, but effectively just advising the regulator that an investigation is going to be undertaken. So, Gerard, what about the confidentiality in terms of the position of the individuals within the firm?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point. In the first instance, involvement in the investigation within a firm I think should be kept to those that need to know. So from a privilege perspective, it's important to have clearly defined who the client is for the purposes of the investigation. But it will also be the case that there may be individuals within the firm that are impacted by the investigation, and the firm will want to be in a position to control and thoughtfully manage how those individuals are approached and informed when it comes to conducting the investigation. And where the investigation is triggered by a whistleblower, for example, the need for confidentiality, I think, becomes even more acute. The firm should have a whistleblowing policy in place that sets out, among other things, how confidentiality is maintained and steps are taken to ensure that the whistleblower doesn't suffer any detriment as a result of having raised concerns.
Yeah, and there's often in a whistleblowing context a lot of focus on the whistleblower, obviously, and the same might be said for, I don't know, a complainant for another misconduct matter and trying to keep them anonymous in certain circumstances, but certainly protecting their confidentiality. But from a firm's perspective and an individual partner's perspective, firms need to think very carefully about also protecting confidentiality of the individual who might be accused. Obviously, for a partner potentially going through an investigation into misconduct, where matters haven't yet been determined and could be immensely reputationally damaging, keeping a very tight group of individuals within the know is really important. And actually, if there are to be leaks, for example, you can well foresee that a partner might allege that there have been breaches of, you know, good faith obligations owed to them or damage caused to their reputation. So that's a lot to think about anyway before the investigation even gets underway. So turning to the investigation then, so where do firms start with the investigation itself?
Yeah, I mean, look, you're right, Anna. A lot of work will already have been done and a lot of thinking done to get to this stage. But done properly, I think the preliminary work should serve the firm well in conducting an effective, efficient, and appropriately monitored investigation. It's also important to remember that at this point, the firm will broadly be in one of two potential scenarios. The firm will either be cooperating with an investigation being conducted by a regulator, either because the issue arose for a firm directly as a result of being informed of a regulatory investigation, or as a result of a firm having taken the decision to self-report and a regulatory investigation initiated as a result. Or the firm will be conducting the investigation itself with or without external advisors, either because the firm has delayed the decision of whether or not to self-report, or of course already determined that that's not necessary, or as a result of agreement with the regulator, for example, that a firm will conduct its own investigation and keep the regulator informed of the progress of that and any conclusions that are drawn as it progresses. Taking the first of these scenarios, so cooperating with an investigation being led by a regulator, at the investigatory stage, a firm will have less control over the process itself. So where, for example, the investigation is being led by the FCA, a firm will receive notification of appointment of investigators and will be invited to attend a scoping meeting with the FCA, where the issues under investigation and next steps can be discussed in more detail. They will then likely follow a series of document and information requests and almost certainly requests to interview those involved or who may be able to help the FCA with the issues they're looking at. And one of the questions that will arise at this stage is whether the firm wants to provide those asked to interview with access to, potentially on a paid for basis, legal advice, either in the form of advisors acting for the firm or in instances where there's a perceived or at least a risk of a conflict between the firm and those individuals, another firm. One key point that should not get lost when firms are responding to and cooperating with a regulatory investigation is the opportunity for firms to make proactive submissions to the regulator, really at any stage. It doesn't all need to be responsive. Firms often have a lot to be gained from putting forward their own case at an early stage in proceedings, presenting any facts they consider to be supportive of their position, as well as the firm's view on the scope of any regulations, for example, said to have been breached.
Okay, so that's in the context, obviously, where the regulator is leading the investigation. Quite different, I suppose, where the firm is conducting the investigation and perhaps liaising with the, well, as you say, the regulator may not yet found it necessary to undertake the investigation, or it may be that they are the firm is internally undertaking the investigation in cooperation with the regulator. What then do they need to think about where they're taking the lead?
Yeah, so I think the onus is on the firm to scope out, the investigation, to map it out. So, what are the particular issues that need investigating? Does a preliminary stage of review need to be carried out in order to understand what the issues might be? What documents need to be searched for, identified and reviewed? What document hold notices need to be in place? Who should be spoken to and interviewed? What can be done to maintain confidentiality and, where possible, privilege over the output of the investigation? I think, depending on the number and nature of the issues under investigation, again, and I feel this is a consistent theme coming out as we speak, but scoping the investigation, again, in and of itself can be a big task, and that is before the investigatory work itself, reviewing the documents, conducting the necessary fact-finding interviews is fully underway.
It's interesting, just looking at this for a moment from the individual's perspective, so in our context, from say a partner's perspective, that actually in some ways it's more favourable for them where it's a regulatory investigation, insofar as you do see quite typically a firm picking up legal fees for an independent advisor. Presumably in interview with the regulator, you would expect the individual to be able to be legally represented or accompanied, versus a position, if you're talking about an internal investigation, very rare is it that the firm is going to proactively pick up legal fees for the individual sort of accused partner. But I'm sure you agree sort of on the importance of that partner taking that advice where they're being taken through the interview, including with an eye on the potential for anything they disclose in an internal investigation, potentially then being disclosed to a regulator in the future.
Yeah, I agree with that, Anna. And certainly in terms of, how frequently or common it is, I think certainly it's in my experience, at least, it's more common for a firm to agree to pick up the tab for independent legal advice for individuals involved in a regulatory investigation, and less likely in the context of an internal investigation.
And in the context of an internal investigation, if as the investigation is conducted, facts emerge that are either support adverse findings or raise new issues, where firms haven't made a notification to the regulator initially and they haven't self-reported, I assume that a firm would need to revisit that earlier decision.
Yeah, absolutely. So firms need to remain aware of that issue throughout the investigation, particularly as any significant developments are identified and progress made. So taking the FCA as an example again, firms have obligations to maintain an open and transparent relationship with the FCA and to disclose appropriately anything relating to the firm of which that regulator would reasonably expect notice. And firms would be required to notify the FCA of breaches of the conduct rules by senior managers and other employees. And, those obligations are ongoing. So as the investigation progresses, a view may have been taken at an early stage that there was no need to make a notification, but that needs to be kept under constant review. And if that position changes, then at the very least, the firm needs to sort of ask itself the question again, whether there's a notification to be made, and if there is, to make it.
Sort of sticking with the firm's internal investigation then, when we get to the point of the investigation being concluded, my involvement at that stage is depending on the outcome of that investigation, what, if any, action needs to be taken as against the, say, individual accused partner, and whether that's looking at the LLP agreement and there's some form of sanction, reduction in points, or whether it's more serious and you might be thinking about expulsion. But from your perspective on that conclusion, what will you be looking at with the firm and advising on?
Yeah, I mean, again, I wish there was a shorter answer, but you know, there are lots of things at play. So where the firm's conducted the investigation itself, it will need to think about issues such as, you know, who should the outcome of the investigation and any report be shared with internally, taking into account, you know, for example, the governance structure in place within a partnership. Who needs to see the output in order to carry out any suggested improvements or remediation work? You know, we've touched on it already. You know, does the regulator need to be informed? And if so, how? You know, what commitments have already been made at earlier points in the investigation in terms of, you know, agreement with regulators and what will be shared with them? On what basis might any report be shared? So on a limited waiver of privilege basis or otherwise? Mm-hmm. Have any issues with employees or partners in the business been identified that need to be managed? And have any sort of customer or client remediation issues been identified that require action?
And then sort of turning to the regulator's investigation, what then when the investigation is being sort of concluded by the regulator?
I think that might need to be a topic for another podcast, Anna, but you know, very broadly, the regulator will either have investigated and then determined that the investigation should be closed without any penalty, sanction, or adverse findings, or, you know, or alternatively, the regulator will pose some sort of action, you know, whether that be public censure, a financial penalty, removal of permissions, or some other form of sanction. And in the latter scenario, the firm will need to consider the implications of the proposed sanction and seek to negotiate it, or failing that, determine whether to accept it or challenge it. But like I say, you know, definitely a very broad topic, hopefully for another podcast. But I mean, decision-making of this nature is, in particular in a partnership context, something that will need to be given thought, you know, quite a lot of thought, including how any conflicts are managed between decision makers.
Yeah, of course. Well, look, thank you. That has been really interesting. It's a lot to think about there. For me, I think what it goes to is the importance of ensuring that whether you're the firm conducting the investigation or participating in responding to, you know, the regulator conducting the investigation, and equally, actually, if you are an individual partner, the importance of taking advice and taking advice that covers both internal sort of the more sort of HR investigation type steps internally, and ensuring that you are treating the partner under investigation or the employee under investigation properly and lawfully, but also that at all times you've got an eye on the, you know, on the regulatory picture. And certainly, if you find yourself in need as a firm to conduct an investigation or to respond to a regulator, Gerard, it's certainly sounds that you are here to help, whether that's it's scoping the investigation, helping assist the firm to actually run the investigation, or indeed presumably carrying out the investigation itself on behalf of the firm.
Exactly, Anna. And, you know, I think you've covered it there, but I hope it's sort of become clear during the course of this podcast, you know, that every investigation is different. And so there, you know, I think there will be internal investigations in particular where firms are in a position to conduct those themselves. I think there will be other investigations where, you know, perhaps the issues at play are more serious or more wide ranging, where the firm needs, you know, can benefit from support in, like you say, just to helping the firm to scope it, providing some direction, being a sounding board for some of the key decisions that arise in the course of investigation. And there will be others where either, you know, because of, you know, the setup of the firm itself, or because of the size and complexity of the investigation, where it makes sense for a firm to be brought in, you know, really to conduct the investigation from, you know, on the ground. So yeah, I mean, our involvement really varies depending on the investigation.
Brilliant. Well, look, thank you so much for your time today. It was great to have a chat.
Thanks, Anna.
Bye.